We'll ask how one evolves into newspaper work today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Christine Hicks didn't set out to become a newspaper person, so why does her name show up in a byline now? And how is Garrison Keillor faring with the Writer's Almanac on Scribble?
Chris, good morning.
Good morning.
Have you always wanted to be a writer?
Well, no, but I've always enjoyed writing. I love words and how they sound, and so I've always kind of been drawn to it.
If you were always interested in writing, what kind of writing did you do?
I've had a couple of articles published in a couple of small magazines.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
Well, you have well-kept secrets, but you did not pursue a career in writing. Why was that?
Well, when I was in college, it was originally my intention to be a teacher. But when I graduated, there weren't very many jobs available, and I was already engaged to be married. Moving out of the area wasn't an option, so I got into secretarial work and eventually paralegal work and then back to secretarial work. So it's just the path my career took.
So how did you end up in newspaper writing?
Well, I kind of like that story. A couple of years ago, I attended a play at the Quad City Theater Workshop. I read the review of that play and hated it. It was not a review per se. It was just a list of characters. So I was terribly incensed because whatever the production was, which I don't remember now, it was an absolutely fabulous performance. So I wrote a blistering letter into the Dispatch complaining about the review. A couple of weeks later, after I'd calmed down, I thought it's not good enough to complain. I had to do something positive. So it so happened I was attending another play, one of those fundraisers that churches have. And on a whim, I wrote a review of that play and emailed it in to Jonathan Turner at the paper explaining why I was submitting it and that I didn't ever expect to get published, but I wanted to do something positive. It was extremely flattering. It was not 15 minutes after I emailed it in. Jonathan replied and asked if I would be interested in reviewing plays when he couldn't make the performance. And that's how I got started.
So you were applying for a job without knowing it, right?
I guess. And then a couple of weeks later, there was a listing in the classified section of the Dispatch looking for correspondents to cover outlying villages. And so I wrote into the Dispatch. A couple of days later, I met with Laura Frams and John Beidler. And one other person, and they assigned me to the Hampton Village Board and the Carbon Cliff Village Board, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Those two don't seem to me to compute. I mean, how do you move from writing great play reviews, which involves some of your own personality and your own feelings, into covering local village politics?
It was a big learning curve. I obviously prefer the creative play reviews more than covering the villages. I had to be very factual. I have to be very factual with the village boards, but I get a little more creativity.
Well, some of them, lately at least, have been theater.
Yes, urban chickens.
How do you stay out of some of the shenanigans that are going? I mean, how do you cover it with a straight face?
It's sometimes difficult. Sometimes difficult. I can't say I haven't rolled my eyes a few times.
Mm-hmm. But that is interesting because reviewing is one thing, but covering the facts and getting all the details is quite another. But how often do you go to board meetings then? How often do they meet?
Twice a month. And mm-hmm. fortunately for me, my time, Carbon Cliff meets on alternate Tuesdays. Hampton meets on the second and fourth Mondays. So I have mm-hmm. one each week, but...
Well, that works out well. But has this given you a taste for reporting? Do you think you'd like to go further?
No, I think this is just fine. When I retired from my bank job, ooh, that sounds like I was robbing them, but I wanted something to supplement my Social Security. So I'm also substitute teaching. And when the newspaper, the reviewing obviously dropped in my lap, but the other, it was just a nice way because you get a flat fee for attending the mm-hmm. meeting, and then you get paid per inch of what they publish in the paper.
I see. Well, that's an invitation to write about 30 inches on a meeting.
Well, unfortunately, about a year after I started reviewing, once the paper started to be printed in Cedar Rapids instead of Moline, they cut back on how many paragraphs I can have for a review. The exception to that is I've also gotten to write 3 feature articles for the Progressive editions that they publish in February. So I've interviewed one of the Circa 21 bootleggers, a docent at the Figge, and a reflexologist, which was in March 5th's mm-hmm. paper because they ran out of space for the Progressive issue in February, but they published it anyway. And then I also got to write a feature article. Last year, I was an election judge for the first time, and I questioned the paper whether they would be interested in something along that vein, and John allowed me to write an article on my experience as a first-time election judge.
Sounds to me like there's an incremental increase in what you're doing.
What is there about your writing that makes it seem so attractive to the papers?
I have no idea. I hope they like the way
I write. There's got to be some magic there because of all the different kinds of things you do, and you must do them well.
Well, and also, we're entering a period of time when full-time staff at a newspaper is limited.
Absolutely.
And they have to find other resources. I assume you're not the only one.
No, I think there are several. As I read the paper, you can tell because from the, in our byline, there's an email address. The people who are, I'm called a correspondent.
Mm-hmm.
We have our personal emails under our byline. If it's a staff member, it'll say whatever at qconline.com.
Yeah. So that's, newspapers have to be very creative in this day and age.
Absolutely.
And that's one of the unhappy things about this age is that the internet has begun to occupy a central place in people's lives, and that is unedited. I mean, anything can show up on the internet perfectly disguised as news or information. And psychologists will tell you that people are ready to believe anything negative. Anything sensational or bad or so on, you automatically believe. And it takes a second movement in your brain to think, oh, wait a minute, that doesn't sound right. So, it's newspapers are edited. That's the big thing. They are edited. Your editors ever give you a hard time?
One time, John questioned what I wrote. He misread it, and so I wasn't wrong. I just had to say, no, this is what I said, and I reminded him, re-emailed my article in, and that was fine. I have only in the... Let's see, I started in September of 2015 doing this, and I just last week got my first reader email criticizing.
Uh-huh. Oh, well, welcome to the club.
Well, I know you're very familiar with that.
That's right.
Right.
What people don't realize is the most valuable thing you can do for any writer in a newspaper is to send a letter to the editor. I don't care if they accuse you of bank robbery. The fact that they write a letter means they read it.
Right. Yeah.
Well, this was just an email sent to my personal account, but I was in Arizona last week visiting my brother, so I got it over my phone. My brother is a retired journalist.
Oh.
And when I we were sitting at the breakfast table, said, "Oh, I got my first complaint from a reader." And he said, "Don't answer it. Don't answer it."
So your brother is a journalist, huh?
He was a sports writer for close to 40 years for the Rockford Register Star.
Ah, I didn't know that. So the ink runs in the family, huh?
I guess.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, part of it comes from my elementary school education. Having gone to a Catholic elementary school, the sisters just drilled us with grammar and sentence composition and all that kind of stuff. So I've always had strong writing skills technically.
Mm-hmm.
And
it seems to me, let me turn to your reviews again, that writing a theater review, you're sort of serving two masters. You have some obligation to the actors that you're going to be writing about and who are in your care, but you also have some obligations to a reader who may want to go to the play. Who wins?
I feel that the theater and the actors win. As a performer myself, I strongly support the performing arts, and I think everybody should avail themselves of that. So it's a pretty fine line I have to tread to give a positive slant, but I've also tried to be honest and kindly bring up things that were possibly a weakness in the performance.
But how do you handle a person you know that you've acted with and they're on stage? That must be interesting.
And that came up recently. I got to review Buried Child over at Quad City Theater Workshop with Pat and Patty Flaherty in the lead roles. But, of course, they're so good. I mean, there wasn't anything bad I could say about that performance. However, I have also reviewed two plays that were put on by Prenzi Players. My criticism there was not the performances. They are all very good actors. The detrimental aspect of those two performances were their sets. Mm-hmm. They were poor. Mm-hmm. And I was pretty harsh with As You Like It because it was ridiculous.
Oh, we just got a critique here.
I was kinder in... Sorry, you folks. Sorry. But I was kind in the written review.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's... I imagine that is tough. We talked to Mike Schultz last week, who's an actor and also a reviewer. And that always is a difficult thing. When you've been on stage, and particularly when you know a lot of people, it's like one of the robbers becoming a cop. Mm-hmm. You know, it's... you have your mind kind of in both worlds. And I've always worried about that. I used to be a reviewer many, many years ago. And I was a very critical reviewer. But since then, I've worked all my life with amateurs. And I look at a play that I've directed and I think, oh boy. But I don't dare say anything because they're doing a good job, given the situation, the actors, the time, and so on. You have to remain positive. But you can take a scalpel to just about any performance you see.
Oh, true. But without doubt, the best production I got to review was right here at Augustana.
Mm-hmm.
I got to review Machinal. It was a stunning, stunning well done production. Every aspect, lighting, set, acting. the only criticism I could make was the gal playing the lead sometimes let her projection drop, and we lost her lines. But I came out of there awestruck. It was so good.
Well, I'm sure you won some friends with that review.
Have you ever wanted to write a play yourself?
Absolutely not.
Well, why not?
I don't think I have enough background or experience to do anything
like
that.
You've just proved otherwise sitting here.
Well, thank you, but I don't think so. I don't know that I could write believable dialogue.
Yeah, that's the hard thing.
Mm-hmm.
I know the thing that's amazing about Shakespeare, although it's an iambic pentameter, every character speaks from the center of his own character. And most authors cannot resist putting themselves in somebody else's mouth. But Shakespeare is, and you've got that model in front of you. What are you going to do? It's just too hard.
Do you get to choose the plays that you review?
Not at all. It's what Jonathan can't get to. A really cute example was I got to review the first theater performance put on by the new Black Box Theater. He emailed me a half an hour before curtain because his son is in show choir over in Davenport.
Oh, yeah.
And they were competing that day, and his choir made it to the semifinals. He had to go into work the next day for a regular shift, so that night was the only night the play could be reviewed and make it to the next edition. So a half an hour ahead of time, fortunately, we happened to be downtown Moline having dinner when I got the email, so it all worked out.
Okay, well, speedy reviews from Christine Hicks. Maybe that should be your working motto.
I do pride myself on getting my reviews in ahead of deadline. In fact, this past weekend, I attended Friday night, and my review was in before noon on Saturday.
I don't want to talk to you if you're one of those people who makes ahead of deadlines.
But part of that was because we were going to Cedar Rapids on Saturday to see the old Creamery Theater performance up there. Saturday was my birthday, and so we were going, and I wanted to get that in because I didn't want to let it sit more than 24 hours. I like to get it down, my thoughts down right away before I forget what I want to write.
Well, we thank you for getting your thoughts down here with us, Christine Hicks, reporter, reviewer. She does it all. And Garrison Keillor merely does Writer's Almanac. Support for Writer's Almanac on WVIK comes from the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products and services to hospitals throughout the region. Information at bloodcenter.org. Well, Roald, what's in the book bag today?
Well, I hope there are listeners who have some interest in Chicago because I just finished reading a great book about Chicago's heyday from about 1935 to 1960, when Chicago transformed everything from American architecture to American television. It's a book called The Third Coast, referring, not Los Angeles or New York, but Chicago, the coast being Lake Michigan. And it's by an author who I'm not familiar with, Thomas Dyja, D-Y-J-A. I don't know how you would even pronounce that. Dyja or something. The subtitle is When Chicago Built the American Dream. It begins in 1935, just as Louis Sullivan has completed the first skyscraper in the world, that took place in Chicago, and he's being replaced by people like Moholy Nagy and Mies van der Rohe, who is coming with his Bauhaus style from Europe and transforming American architecture even more. The blacks are beginning to flood into the south side of Chicago from the south because of poverty conditions down there.
And that big flood of 27 started it.
Right, and Gwendolyn Brooks is just being born and living in the slums and turning out to be eventually the poet laureate of Illinois. All kinds of people. And television, the first Kukul, Fran, and Ollie show, it turns out, was all improvisational.
Mm-hmm.
Television had never done that before. Well, television itself was early, but they sort of redefined the way, you know, that show could go on for an hour and a half, and it turns out it was all improvised.
Yeah.
Not even the founder of it knew what was going to happen to those characters. They just started talking to each other, and pretty soon they had a program.
And Dave Garraway.
Dave Garraway, and it is interesting to me because from 1955 to about 1960, I was a student at the University of Chicago. So I went to one of the first performances of a group called the Compass Players in a bar down on 57th Street. And it turns out that the two people who were running that were Mike Nichols and Elaine May. Severin Darden was there, that 300-pound actor, and also Shelley Berman. And they did improvisational theater. They eventually became Second City, but they transformed improvisational theater in the United States. I was there one night in 1956 when the way they did plays was people in the audience would make suggestions. And then with about 5 minutes preparation, they would put on a play based upon that suggestion. The night I was there, one of the nights, somebody shouted out, "Garden of Eden." And immediately Mike Nichols and Elaine May were Adam and Eve down in front of a screen of flowers. And Severin Darden, all 300 pounds of him, was leaning over. He was God. And they did about 12 minutes of improv in closed couplets.
Mm.
I could not believe it. And Mike Nichols, of course, went on to bigger and better things. I was there the night Shelley Berman was famous for his... a telephone would ring on stage, and Shelley Berman would come in and answer it, and it was a one-man show. And the night he was there, he came in, and it turns out his best friend is calling him to talk about the big party that he missed because he wasn't invited to last night. And you start out laughing your head off, right, because this poor little schmuck, the friend has no real use for him. And he's bragging about being at the party when you weren't at the party, yeah, yeah. All of which you just get from Shelley Berman's comments. And by the time the phone hangs up, you know, you're sniffling.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And, Hyde Park was undergoing transformation. The University of Chicago under Hutchinson was, you know, in the 30s and 40s was just reaching its heyday. Doing all kinds of the great books by Mortimer Adler was going on.
He withdrew the University of Chicago from football.
Yeah. Yes, he did. And to make sure that it would never come back, he burned the marching band uniforms. So I just, by sheer accident, the great Chicago writer during that period was Nelson Algren, who was having an affair, it turns out, with Simone de Beauvoir. And she would come to Chicago frequently. Unbelievable book, The Third Coast by Thomas Deha.
Okay, and with that, we're going to head for the exit, and we thank you very much for your kind attendance. We'll see you next week on the next edition of Scribble.